Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm in a really reminiscent mood.
Why is that?
Well, the word that's been stuck in my head for the last week is memorable.
Oh.
And that is because I was just at FIAC in Paris. And
That's an art fair, right?
That's an art fair for people that don't know that. Mm-hmm. And because it was like a big art thing, there were obviously a lot of people that loved art there. And they kept walking up to me the whole time saying, "Oh my God, you're the guy from the podcast. I love your podcast," in many different accents. So we had people from like South Korea.
What, were they putting them on or were they...
No, babes. They were actually from
accents.
Different countries.
Oh, okay, right.
So there were people from like, I met an Icelandic person. I met a Russian person. No, it's hilarious though. I had no idea we had all these international listeners. Anyway, and one guy in particular who was French was trying to say that he wanted to speak to me at Freeze Art Fair and he couldn't come up to me because he thought I was intimidating.
You are.
And then, but he didn't use the word intimidating. He said memorable. So he was saying to me like, "I couldn't come up to you because you're just so memorable." And I was like, okay. And then at the end, when he left, he said, "Oh, I'm so glad I did get the guts to speak to you because you're totally unmemorable." And then he walked off and I was like... So then it got me thinking. Then it, oh, it made Russell laugh. So then it got me... So then it got me thinking and I politely said, "Thank you, thank you." And then my friend Gigi, who was waiting for me, I told her, and she was just like, "Why didn't you correct him?" But then it got me thinking about what's memorable to me. And then you mentioned we were going to interview the guest today.
Yes.
And I've had a few times in my life where I'd met him before and each time has been very memorable. And one of the things is obviously he's in a global, rock pop band. And there's a song called Day Sleeper that he wrote, which often comes back to me. And I think I spoke to Thomas about it before, actually. But for some reason, I get the lyrics quite a lot in my head. And there was something about that song that was very significant to me because of the idea of otherness and like the idea of someone sleeping through the day and they're not part of the normal society of everyone going to work and waking up and eating lunch and all that stuff. And then to me, it kind of was this metaphor for otherness and queerness and kind of like growing up feeling different to the rest of the world. So for me, that song, along with Pet Shop Boys' Home and Dry, they're the two songs that for some reason I sing to myself like randomly a lot. And then I got a taxi journey once in New York with this guest. I was at Patti Smith's exhibition and I jumped in a taxi with our guest and Douglas Copeland and had the most surreal taxi journey because I didn't know either of them. And we were just chatting and then he introduced me to Patti as we arrived.
Wow.
And it was just like totally memorable.
What was the exhibition then? What work
it was
a
solo exhibition of her photographs.
Wow.
And I got invited by a curator that I didn't even know. And he was like, wrote to me out of the blue and just said, "Do you want to come and meet Patti Smith?" And I was like, yes.
Oh yeah.
So I went to the dinner and I ended up meeting our guest.
Wow.
So yeah, memorable was the word I've had in my mind.
Rob.
So we would like to welcome Michael Stipe.
The original day sleeper.
How are you, Michael?
I slept really late today, actually, and I feel good.
Because so we're in London now doing this interview, and you're in London now at the moment.
We're in London, and this is not live, right?
No.
I mean, we're alive, and that's a good
thing. We're alive.
Okay.
Very much so.
Yeah.
We're very much alive,
you
and you can swear, and you can do anything you want.
Yeah. Great. What brings you to London?
I'm here doing promotion ostensibly for a record that came out 25 years ago called Monster by my former pop band, R.E.M. And we've repackaged it and put out this whole other thing. So I was here doing radio and TV and a bunch of interviews. But I also just had this book that came out. And I also just released my first ever solo single, which I didn't coordinate it to happen all at the same time. But as it turns out, it all happened at the same time. So I've been doing triple duty and not getting a whole lot of sleep.
How has that been? Has that been exhausting?
I'm really tired, yeah. Wow. But I look great.
You do look Thank you. Fantastic.
Thank you.
My God.
You also look very colourful. I'm loving your outfit today.
Thank you.
Well, he's wearing orange, Rob.
I know, it's my favourite colour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I knew that.
So that makes me happy.
I did a little bit of investigating myself.
Thanks.
It's funny what you say about Day Sleeper, because I actually wrote that character as a woman. And then my idea for the video for it, the directors were like, no. And they're Icelandic. And so I followed their lead.
Oh, wow.
And it might have been the same guy that approached you at FIAC. Who knows? and so I wound up cast in the role of the lead character of that song as myself, or as some male version of me. But it's sweet. It's really sweet that song beckons otherness into your memory.
That's beautiful. Definitely. Yeah.
Thank you.
And
I love that song. It's really hard to sing. I don't know how you sing it in the shower.
Well, he sings it in his head, don't you?
Yeah, I do sing it out loud sometimes.
Do you?
Yeah, I do often sing to myself. Probably not.
Sing a bit
anymore.
Now?
No, babes.
We'll do it.
I used to be a singer. It's also, it's like really embarrassing for me to like sing in front of Michael.
We'll get all warmed up and we'll do it later.
Yeah, another time.
But we're talking about you doing the music video, because you are completely across all the kind of parts of the music videos, like creatively.
Yeah.
That was something that was really important to you.
Yeah, I did everything. I did everything creative. I did everything visual for the band, except dress the guys. So all the graphic. I think I was actually meant to be a graphic artist, and I failed at that. But I was able to kind of funnel that interest into the work that I did with REM. So all the videos, all the graphics, all the photographers, working with the video directors, working with the people that did films for the live shows that we did, all the stuff that was presented on stage, I did all of it. All the merchandise for 31.
Oh, really? All the merch
for 31 years. Yeah, it was a lot to oversee.
So you was across all like what was being printed on the t-shirt,
every single thing that you ever saw.
Oh, we just got some bread coming in for you.
Yay, my bread! Thank you, Breadman.
Thank you, Breadman.
Here comes the bread.
This is fantastic.
Left the conversation.
That is a lot of bread. That's like a loaf.
They're just... actually done toasted and not toasted.
Oh,
I'm going to go for toasted.
What are you going to go for?
Detail.
I'm going to go for toasted.
You are.
Ooh, that's nice, because they made the effort for that.
Anybody else want to?
So what do you mean you're a failed graphic artist then?
Well,
you studied in Georgia.
I became a pop star instead.
Right.
So
so if you hadn't been a pop star, do you think you would have definitely gone down the art route and become a visual artist or a graphics artist?
Absolutely. I would have done photography. And I think I probably would have wound up doing graphic design.
Wow. Yeah. What I found really interesting doing research for the interview was that I hear that when you write songs, you normally see it first in your mind.
I do.
And you see kind of pictures or almost like moving images that then become a song. So like Night Swimming, for example, would have been a vision you have almost that you then take and people kind of turn in. I love that phrase.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to ask, is my chewing too loud, Mr. Engineer? Or is it okay? It's okay. So I can chew. Hardly. Okay, I'm going to.
The only really person that won't like it will be Luke Evans, the actor, because he's got a thing where he doesn't like the sound, and he came on our show, and then he did it himself.
Luke. He's so great. No, he just turned 40, right?
Yes, he did.
That guy.
But Luke actually ate on the show, and I was like, you're doing what you don't like. It was hilarious.
What are those videos called that people put up on...
When they're kind of clipping with their long nails on the keyboard and then chewing gum. I don't know what they're called, but they're horrific.
It's become a thing now.
Yeah, it's a condition.
It's a fetish.
No, but it was a thing years ago.
What's it called? ASMR.
Yeah, ASMR somehow entered into like consumer society in America, and I think they're doing. There was a what's it called? The big. I'll do this to my microphone. it's the big sports event that involves football, and there's a part in the middle where sad performers get up and perform.
Oh, the Super Bowl.
The Super Bowl, that's what it's called.
Well, it's not all sad, because I quite liked Gaga's one.
We're whispering now.
Okay, sorry. I liked Gaga's one.
I thought it was ludicrous.
I like Gaga. I'm going to fight for Gaga.
I actually like her.
So do I, because I think it's good to have people who have good intentions within powerful pop positions.
Yeah, she's a good talker too. She really, she knows what she wants to say, and she goes for it. I like her.
Good.
As a force out there.
So this book that you've just brought out, this is the second volume from a series of books, which is over 38,000 photographs, or over 38 years worth of photographs that you've accumulated, and now you're putting out in these volumes. How did the decision come about to do that? Why did you...
I'm, I put out a book in 1997 or 98 mm-hmm. where Patti Smith had come back from her husband died. She moved back to New York and decided to start performing again. And Bob Dylan invited her to open for him on the road and for 10 dates, I think. And she told me about it. She said, "Do you want to come along for a couple of shows?" I said, "Sure." So I jumped on the bus and I didn't get off. And I had my camera with me and I photographed the whole 2 weeks. And then the idea was presented that I make a book out of these images. Now, there, if you find the book, if you're able to find it, it's more diaristic. It's more kind of, it's really just a diary of what happened. They're not great photographs. There's a few beautiful portraits, but it's really just kind of the kind of daily grind of performing. And then there's, you know, there's some special guests like Gregory Corso and Thurston Moore and Kim Gordon and people that came, Allen Ginsberg, people that came to see Patti perform or came to see the show. I put that out. I decided then and there that I was going to release a photo book a year for the rest of my life.
Really?
Yeah. But it was 20 years before I managed to get the next photo book.
Sadly. Right. But you got 20 years of photography during that period.
Yeah. So
you take
yeah.
photographs every day, do you?
I do. I don't write in a diary. I don't have a journal. I have a schedule, which is kind of fascinating. I've kept all my schedules since 1984, I think.
Would you publish them?
No, they're ridiculous. But I like looking back and remembering. My God, that's that night that I had in Brussels with so and so, so and so, and so and so, where we got lost and someone lost their shoe, and then we had to find a taxi. But it was raining. All these things come flooding back to me when I look at them.
Wow.
But the same happens with photography, and photographs are just much more for me. Much more memorable of a moment or a day or an event. I took pictures of my room. I told you about my hotel room here. They put me up in a normal room. I said, I don't need anything fancy. Just give me a room with a window that opens. I'll take the smallest room in the hotel. That's what I really want. It doesn't matter. I'm not going to be there anyway except to sleep. And they put me in the biggest suite, the biggest suite that they have, with windows looking out over all of London. And so I took pictures the whole time, and I have those to go back to. I have a kind of beautiful... I'm not going to share it.
No?
No.
But will you put these pictures in a volume in the next 20 years' time?
I can. The story I was about to tell you will wind up in the next book.
Aha.
Okay, so we'll all buy the next book and then we'll find
but
it.
But we've got to wait 20 years.
But actually,
I'll tell the story then. I have to hold on to it now because it's with someone who I love very much who just left us. So I'm gonna hang on to that one.
Okay, cool. So you've taken more than 37,000 photographs. That was like before the volume one.
So I was right then. I said over 38 years, but there was that amount of photos. It's like, wow.
Yeah. And I've actually been taking pictures since I was 14. So I'm 59 now. That's 45 years. Is that 44 years of pictures?
And that was your dad's Nikon?
Yeah. Which was nicked when I moved into a church with Peter Buck, my former guitar player, and Mike Mills, my former bass player, and Bill Berry, my former drummer. When I was 19 years old, and someone broke in and stole the camera.
No,
and
no
a bunch way. Of a bunch of weed and a big jar of pennies. And we were so dirt poor that we actually had a jar of pennies, and they took our fucking jar of pennies, which was not very cool. The cops came. You know, was there anything else they were really looking for? We're like, no, sir. I think this is all that was taken. But my father had insurance on the camera, so he bought me another one at the age of 20. And that was the camera that I used. I still have it, actually. Yeah, I still.
Do you still use the same?
In fact, the images of Alexandru, who's here with me today, who you guys just met, in the book, were shot with that camera.
So, what's Alexandru's role with you? Does he work with you?
No, we're friends.
Oh, okay.
He just happened to be in the same part of London that I was today, and he met me at a bookstore where I signed a bunch of books.
He was at Hatchard's,
and
right?
You were there.
Yeah. I know. I was there because I came from Margate this morning, so I've moved by the seaside.
Wow.
And I came up on the train, and I said to Russ, I haven't actually seen I'd seen the volume one before, but I didn't own it. And then I hadn't seen the new book yet because it's just come out. Mm. And I said, I think we need to get it because I really want to have it. And then I ran across London, and there was one store that had it, Hatchard's.
On Piccadilly.
I get there, and I run up to the guy who's running the art department. And I'm like, I'm doing an interview. I need to find this book. Please have it. And he was like, who are you interviewing? And I was like, oh, Michael Stipe. And he was like, but who are you? So we got in like a very deep conversation. And then you were upstairs signing your book.
I was upstairs that very moment, signing books.
Bizarre.
And then you text me and said, apparently you were just in the store, which was kind of like,
but he texted you saying, ha ha ha, Hatchards, which I really liked. that was good. So the funniest thing I thought about this experience of buying the book today, or books plural, is that they were signed. And I know that you also don't like your own handwriting.
Yeah, your autograph or your signature.
Yeah,
let me see how good I did.
Okay.
Because over the course of an evening, the hand, the signature can get pretty.
Why don't you
janky.
Like your own? Do you like your own handwriting in general?
That's a really
just,
good one.
And it's just not your signature or your autograph. Or?
So volume one has a really good autograph. And you got two great ones. Wow. Oh, okay.
For you. Did Russell
what did, what
no.
did I get? What did I get?
I got him.
I haven't got the shit ones.
To,
I'll have to swap.
I happen to have brought the very same pencil, so we'll be able to. That one's very good.
Thank you.
And
here we go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The big reveal.
This is for...
Not bad.
Oh,
ooh, yes.
I can tart it up a little for you.
Can you just swap it over with Rob's
book? No.
So why don't you like your autograph or your signature?
I don't like my line. I started as a drawing and painting major. I failed miserably in philosophy and English literature. I can't read very well. And moved into the drawing and painting department of the art, art school at the University of Georgia as an 18-year-old. And... I really just wanted to get laid and hang out with the kids who knew what espresso was and knew who the Beat Generation were. And
right. Can you explain the Beat Generation as well in a minute? We have to come back to
sure,
that.
Sure. And knew punk rock. And that was all those kids were in the art school. Mm-hmm. I started with drawing and painting, and I'm just the world's worst painter. I can't paint to save my life. If the future of the world hinged on me painting something that was passable as a contemporary art piece, we would be fucked. and along with that, I don't like my speaking voice, but I'm here with you because I like both you guys. And I do love my singing voice, but I don't like my speaking voice. Most of us don't. And I don't like my signature. I just don't like my line. I don't think it doesn't feel authentic or genuine to me.
So when you...
that's touching on, you know, years of therapy that I never got. And, compound issues of insecurity, but... I'm self-aware enough to know it and talk about it.
When did you know you liked your own voice then? If you didn't like your
singing voice?
Your singing voice.
I didn't like it until... Let me think.
Did you like it before you'd heard it recorded?
No. Well, I did my first ever recording when I was 9.
Right.
No, wait, hang on. No, let's back this up. Well, I wasn't 9. I lived in outside of East St. Louis in Illinois. I was at least 13. Mm-hmm. Everyone had left the house, and my sister had a secretary's cassette recorder that secretaries would take dictation on. And I went up to her room. I had a cassette that had something on it. I don't know what, but I hit record and I yelled. I screamed for as long as the cassette played until it stopped. And that was my first ever recording. I listened back to it once, and now I wish I had. My God, I wish I had that cassette.
Wow.
But yeah, I think it was, I would have been 13 or 14 years old.
And you liked it though?
No, I don't know what I was doing. I think it was just some expression of puberty, you know,
mm-hmm.
Isolation, who knows? but I think it was maybe the third album, the third REM album is when I listened to my voice and I went, okay, there's something here. It took several records for me to arrive there.
And you like performing?
I do love to perform.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that exchange of energy between the audience and myself. And I miss it a little bit. The band disbanded in 2011, and I haven't performed since 2008, really.
But so, this new single you just released, you'll be performing that?
No, not so much. Probably not.
Really?
I'm not so interested or excited about the idea of touring.
Right.
And in order to break even, much less make money on that kind of venture, you kind of have to do more than one show.
Would you do like a talk show and perform?
Yeah, I've been asked.
You've been actually, asked?
Yeah, around this single. So there's a chance of that. But TV's really different, you know. You can fuck it up and stop, and they hate that, but you can start again.
Right, right, right.
So the new single, all the money that is raised from that, if people choose to purchase it, because you have a choice either to download it for free from michaelstipe.com or you give money to charity for Extinction Rebellion, is that right?
That's right.
And so it's basically a fundraising exercise as well as being a creative exercise, which is really wonderful because it's help the world, I guess.
I hope so. I mean, I'm a member of Extinction Rebellion. I'm a proud member, and I think it's one of the most exciting things that 2019 has offered us.
So I bought it last night.
Thank you.
And I've watched the video, which you've made with an artist, Sam Taylor Johnson, who's also become a global film director and friend of ours as well, who we love her very much.
I do too.
But how did that come about, that collaboration, but also the content in the film? Because it's an amazing short film.
It's incredible. I'm so proud of it.
Yeah.
I needed something visual to go along with the single, and I wanted to package, I wanted to bundle the single with a stencil, a GIF of a portrait of me, a lyric sheet that I did the graphic design on. It's really bad, but and it's not bad, but it's not great. And I did it on a Mac, and then a video, but you know, whatever a music video is in 2019. And I had ideas for what I wanted, but I couldn't think of how I could shoot it myself, and I couldn't think of someone who could do it for me. And then one night around 2 a.m., I was like, fuck, it's Sam. Sam, I know I can reach out to her, and I know that she'll be able to pull this together. So I texted her, and I said, she had done a video for my former band's last record. She did a video for a song called Uberlin, featuring her husband, Aaron Taylor Johnson, who's a movie star and actor, a really good actor.
He is, yeah.
And Dancing Through the Streets of London, beautiful piece. Mm-hmm.
He's a really good dancer as well.
He's a really good dancer, my God. Yeah, I've been doing this whole thing where I ask people to dance for me, and then I compose to their movement. And Aaron and I have decided to do that together, although it's been a few years. So I need to circle back and get him to dance for me.
What, wow. So he just does it like with no music?
No,
like
I acapella. No, dancing. I did a really shitty 120 BPM track that has really standard like guitar and bass. It's very, very bad. It's mm-hmm. very, very rudimentary, intentionally, because I wanted it to be a little bit banal for the dancer to have to work around something that's not particularly inspiring mm-hmm. and do something with that. And so it's this kind of very steady 120 BPM beat, which was disco when I was growing up. When I was a teenager, it was the disco era. And so that was important to me. But I give them that, and then I strip the music away, and I just watch what I have on tape and pick a part of it. And there's a few, actually, there's several images in the book mm-hmm. of people that dance for me. Thibaut Lac is a dancer.
Would you put Casey these out as Legler. Performance art pieces, would you say? Or
Casey Legler is a performance artist. She uses her body in her work, and she was actually the first woman to be hired as a male model at Ford Modeling Agency. So she spearheaded the whole gender kind of post-gender, the whole fluid idea. In the fashion industry. But she's in there. She did one of those dance pieces for me.
So the new video is a kind of portrait of a young girl.
Oh yeah, I really went off there. Sorry. So yeah, I texted Sam, and thank you for bringing me back. I texted Sam and I said I need something to represent this new single. And she said, absolutely, I'll do it. And she had heard we were on vacation together this summer, so she knew the song. And she was thrilled to do it. And she delivered this incredible, I could cry talking about it. I couldn't imagine something that more captures the spirit and the intensity of the narrative in the song. The character that I'm trying to portray in that song is beautifully, beautifully portrayed in this video. So I'm really thrilled with it.
I recommend everybody watch it and download it. Mm-hmm. I actually was quite surprised when I heard the song, because the title, for some reason, Your Capricious Soul, it made me think it was going to be like a ballad, like a kind of, you know what I mean? Like a slower, very emotional song. For some reason, that's what it conjured up to me. And when I heard it, it was like really kind of poppy, happy, upbeat. It's an amazing track.
Thank you. I'm really proud of it. Mm. Thanks. Well, there's more coming, so that's exciting.
So I need you to clear up what the beat generation is. I hear that a lot. And it was in correlation with William Burroughs, the novelist who you met at some point, and he was your queer grandfather?
Godfather, yeah.
Godfather. But he's part of the Beat Generation. Now, for me, the Beat Generation, what is that exactly?
The Beats were a loose group of friends who were creative thinkers, artists. They were kind of, they were all white, actually, now that I think about it, and all American, I think, and mostly male and not at all straight, as it turns out. They loved jazz and they followed it and they started kind of creating their own idea of jazz, but as poets and writers. And I think the whole thing really, Allen Ginsberg to me would probably be the center of the Beats. Mm-hmm. Because Allen had a certain cadence to his voice, a profound intellect, but a way of talking that is very easy to mimic. If you've ever been around someone who has a really strong personality and you find yourself talking like them or walking like them or eating like them or laughing like them, I think Allen had that effect on the people around him.
Did you see it? You could actually see it, like the ripple of that.
I recognized it when I met Alan and hung out with him.
Did you copy any of his traits?
You goddamn right I did.
Did you? What did you pick
well,
up?
It's the cadence of the voice, and I can't do it now. I'm a really bad imitator.
But like a tonality of it,
I think it's the way that thoughts came to him and the way that he expressed himself, but also he had this kind of rolling, lilting aspect to his, you know who it reminds me of? Weirdly, Edith Sitwell, of all people.
Okay.
It's kind of the way Edith Sitwell read her own poetry when she did.
Which there are recordings of, aren't there?
There are recordings of her in the 1920s.
They're amazing.
She hired a guy to compose music on trash cans, and she sang through a megaphone. She was radical. And she, you know, she's, what's it called? Plantagenet. I've never heard the word.
Plantagenet.
Yeah, thank you. What does that mean, in fact?
It's a religion, isn't it?
Oh, no, I think it's like
pilgrims or something.
She came from very, very well, a very wealthy and very renowned English family.
Okay.
So she was like royalty, kind of.
It's like a trust fund kid.
Yeah. She would have been a trust fund kid in the 20s. Yeah. But, you know, she wound up, befriending the beat generation of that time, which was, of course, Gertrude Stein and the whole Paris Salon kind of fell into her lap. Pavel Chilichev, she was madly in love with, apparently. He painted her many, many times. Mm-hmm. And he moved to America and fell in love with Charles Henry Ford. And lived out, I think, the rest of his life. And he's an amazing painter. Do you know his work?
No.
Chilichev.
Do you know it, Rob?
I don't know.
Pavel Chilichev, yeah. He's incredible.
What was it saying that Plantagenet was?
Just looked it up. And it was like a royal kind of
lineage
English.
A royal house
of England. It was a dynasty.
Yeah.
I think it says...
Oh, that's a surname. Like
Angevin or Anjou dynasty. And it reigned from 1154 until 1485.
So like the Tudors or something.
I guess so, yeah. But before that, probably even... Yeah,
interesting. So she was related to them, that we went as far back as
I think
as
so. I don't know why I associate her name with that word, but I do. And I'm embarrassed. I didn't know how to say it. How do you say it again?
Plantagenet.
Yeah. And her brother...
I might be saying it wrong, but...
Her brother's name was Osbert, and they were these characters, and I think he was queer. And they were... But he was this polarizing character. He was satirized in a book by Aldous Huxley at the time. I think it's called Those Barren Leaves. I'm really pulling this out of my ass. but he's this like unbelievable character, and everyone knew when the book came out who it was. Of course, that was Osbert Sitwell and his wacko sister Edith. But anyway, Alan had that kind of voice that you just wanted to kind of be that. And then there was Kerouac, of course, Jack Kerouac, and there was Neil Cassidy, who I think Jack was kind of in love with. And Neil Cassidy was this charismatic, unbelievably handsome, bisexual man who was a true free spirit. He came from a very broken family. He expressed himself a lot through drugs and alcohol, but he was truly what we would call a free spirit. He would, and he was very, very sexual. And so I think he slept with a lot of women, a lot of men, including most of his friends.
How did you come to meet Alan then?
I met Alan through... Patti Smith. Uh-huh. And Patti opened up... I mean, I actually met William Burroughs through Kim Gordon and Thurston Moore. Sonic Youth were on tour with R.E.M. in 1995, and we had a day off in Kansas, and they invited me to join them to William's house in Kansas. And so we went and spent the day with him. That was incredible.
And you photographed William?
I photographed him, yeah, that day, in fact. And then I developed a relationship with him. You know, he knew who I was, but we were not friends at all. I didn't have his cell phone number. But he and Patti were very, very, very close. And so I wound up going back to Kansas with her at some point for this celebration of William's life by most of his friends. And that's actually where I met John Giorno for the first time.
Yeah.
One of the most charismatic and one of the most sexy men or women, the sexiest man I've ever met.
Rest in power, that's so sad.
I could cry. He from across the room, I was just like, who is that man? And then he came over and he gave me this giant hug and kissed me on the mouth.
Wow.
And said, you must come to New York and stay with me. And I was like, oh, good.
How old was you then?
I was 35.
And he was an established, well-known artist at that point, making...
I didn't know who he was at the party, right. But then someone said, that's John Giorno. I was like, holy shit, I know who that is. You know, I've read his name for years.
Yeah.
No wonder, you know, no wonder I've read his name for years. Look at that creature. He was so gorgeous and amazing. And talk about an intellect. That guy could really pull the most disparate.
Poet. Yeah. I
mean, incredible. Yeah. Yeah, incredible. So God rest him.
Yeah.
God rest his soul.
John Giorno. So going back to photography.
Yeah.
That you saw...
Oh, and Alan was there. Sorry. Now I circle around to answering your question. Alan and William go back decades, and Patty and Alan and William go back decades. So it was through Patty Smith that I met Allen Ginsberg.
Right. Wow.
And he's actually featured in the first photo book.
And Patty's like one of your best mates in the world, is she?
We are. I mean, I get all shy when I say that, but yeah. Yes, I love her very, very much. And it's one of those, you know, it's a storybook. It's unbelievable that it was her record that changed my life as a 15-year-old.
Which one was it?
Horses. I bought it the day it came out. I listened to it all night long. And that morning I said, that's what I'm going to do. And then I just set out to find the band that could help me do that.
Wow.
And, but that 20, almost to the day, 20 years later, we would meet in Detroit, Michigan. Her husband had died and she was grieving, deeply grieving. But she and her husband knew my band from MTV and knew who I was. And she was really excited to meet me, which blew my mind. But it was one of those things, like when you and I met, I mean, I felt instantly like this is a long term. This is real. You can feel, you feel the realness right away. I felt that with Patty.
Did you meet Robert Mapplethorpe?
We never met.
You never met?
No.
Had he already passed when you met Patty? No.
Yeah. He had been gone 6 years when Patty and I met.
Right. Yeah. Do you like his work?
Very much. I think he's incredible.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah. And there's some stuff that's going around right now that his work isn't as shocking as it used to be. And so we have to look at it through a different lens. And I think it's a lot of horseshit.
I think it is. I mean, it is as shocking. I went to the Gay Lesbian Museum in...
Leslie Loman.
Worcester Street in New York.
Yeah,
and
Leslie Loman.
A whole series there of the models with their penises out and like really like kind of like graphic S&M imagery, which in the 80s at the time would have been extremely shocking. And I think, and even now, it's still shocking to see that.
I agree.
To see that, and to see that kind of in auction catalogue sometimes, these images are just there and they're really like fisting and stuff. It's like really extreme. I don't agree with that at all. It's still, I think if my mum walked into a gallery and saw that, I think she would be like, oh my God, what's that?
I think they're also incredibly timeless works. Like they
so
capture,
important.
They of course capture a specific era, but they also become so much about human nature and human psychology that they'll just last forever.
Yeah.
And I saw the Francis Bacon show last week in Paris, and the same thing with those paintings. Those paintings are so transcendent
but
and so
haunting,
timeless.
Aren't they?
And haunting and disturbing, which is why his photography is so good as well.
Yeah.
Because it is a bit haunting and it kind of gets to the truth of the matter, like it gets to who we are as humans, which I think is such a hard thing to do as an artist, to actually get to that point. People can try and pretend to do it and they'll show you a version of it that looks like, and it might even be successful, but those kind of artists don't ever last the test of time.
Yeah.
Whereas I think he will, you know.
I would argue that a true artist can from time to time misstep and create inauthentic work. And that to me, when I find the shitty piece by Brancusi, which I did find.
Right.
I went, oh, okay, he's that good that he really stepped off a cliff with this one and it didn't work, in my opinion.
Yeah.
What was it?
Well, there's a few.
Was it a period he actually did this? Or
it was earlier work. And the influences, I think, were very different than his later work was, I think, most definitely influenced by African.
Yes.
Tribal
arts and stuff,
And that's a whole other conversation. But Brancusi,
pre-sculpture, was it? But this was more the...
No, it was sculpture. Right. Yeah, sculpture work. But not very good. And I liked it that I found the Brancusi piece that wasn't like, that didn't descend from heaven.
Uh-huh.
That made him all the more real.
Yeah, all the more human. Yeah, exactly.
So you see photography as, in part, as important as music to you. That's always been something that you've seen. And for many years, you felt quite frustrated that people weren't accepting that as a kind of multifaceted quality to you.
Not frustrated, that's not the right term, but I think people thought, oh, I'm a hobbyist and this is my hobby.
Right.
This is something that I do on the side.
It's a folly or something.
Yeah, that because I have this insanely velocity, this life that's filled with travel and fascinating people and places and I document it that it's a folly, yeah, and it's not. It's something that I do. I mean, for me, photography and music are the easiest mediums for me to express myself in. That's not to say that I shouldn't experiment with other mediums, and I like experimenting with other mediums, like video, like dance, which I know nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
So to work with a contemporary dancer and ask them to dance to this really shitty piece of music that mm-hmm. I wrote, and then knowing that I'm going to pull that music away and compose to their movement, they're really taking a chance, and they're exposing themselves, and they're giving me a part of themselves that I don't think I would get if I were a choreographer or someone who knew a great deal about contemporary dance.
Mm-hmm.
I like that as a creative, let's use that term instead of artist, as a creative person, I like that that I can kind of move off and try these other forms and see how they work.
Mm-hmm.
or combining them.
Who do you look at in photography then, as someone contemporary or historical?
Wolfgang Tillmans.
Yes. And you've sat for Wolfgang Tillmans, haven't you?
I did sit in his green chair. I was over to his place for dinner, and this was 1,000 years ago. And he...
This was in London, or Berlin?
In London, yeah. The old, near Old Street.
Yeah.
And he had that place. And he would often put up... I'd been to a studio enough times in his apartment to know that he would put up new work on the wall to just kind of live with it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So he had all these new pieces up on the wall, and it was this guy who kind of looked like a skinhead. He had a Mohican, and he's naked, and he's very attractive, and he's peeing on a green chair.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, this is new. Like, I haven't seen this.
It's like an office chair, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're in the kitchen, and Wolfgang at the time, his color printer was also in the kitchen, and it's an enormous machine. So there wasn't really room for a third person. It's like a two-fanny kitchen, as my grandma would call it. So they're in there cooking dinner, and Wolfgang's like, have a seat at the table. Here's some wine. I'm like, okay. So they're talking to me through the door, and Wolfgang's like, what do you think of the new work? And I'm like, oh, it's kind of amazing. I mean, that shot of the guy pissing on the chair, my God. And Wolfgang's like, do you like the chair you're sitting in? And I was like, and I realized I'm sitting in the chair.
No.
And I'm like, you fucker. How fucking dare you? You motherfucker.
Did you pose in that chair, the photo?
It was the same chair, yeah.
No. Did it smell?
No, it didn't smell. It's a different chair. But I mean,
he had seven or eight of them.
But, but he was, of course, it was a big joke. And they had set it up. Perfect. You know, they set me up for a big fall. So that was good.
Do you like being a muse for other photographers?
Do I like being a muse?
Yeah, do you like sitting? A muse.
Yeah. I love to be photographed. Yeah.
Do you?
I really do, yeah. Yeah.
I
think I've got a good head and you know, from the right, I've got bad angles. You're at one of them right now.
Like, okay.
If you were a photographer taking my picture, I would turn to give you my Warhol face, which is the straight on, and I kind of know my eyes are slightly crooked, like Patty's, like Alexandra's in the next room, something that I really admire, like Kate Moss, Grant Lee Phillips from Grant Lee Buffalo, River Phoenix, some of my favorite people have eyes that are slightly off. Mine are a little bit off, and they're more so off when I'm a little bit tired. I have to really focus to, I look normal in person, I think. I don't look like my eyes are that wonky.
I'm looking at your eyes now.
Yours are a little off too.
Thanks.
Yeah, in a good way.
That's why you like me.
Yeah. My friend took method acting as an actor and writer when we were in our early 20s, and for some reason, he had this very emotional response when he saw men on the street with slightly crossed eyes. He would burst into tears.
Wow.
And to this day, that was 38 years ago. To this day, he has no idea why. But
through method acting, though, through like...
Yeah, it was something that came...
Triggered
wow.
From deep, deep, deep inside. He wouldn't mind me saying that on the show. But...
So your angles, so your Andy Warhol angle.
I have to be very careful. I have to concentrate to look at you with my right eye so that in the photograph, I don't look slightly... cross-eyed or drunk.
Boss.
I look drunk.
You look drunk.
Actually, wow. I look drunk, yeah. I look drunk.
And this is something you perfected over years after seeing lots of pictures of yourself.
I can't say I perfected it, but if you were a photographer and I didn't know you and you were taking my picture from that angle, you're at a 45-degree angle for me. So it's a three-quarter. I would turn to change the angle.
Nice.
Well, it's good that you know your angles. But
if you were Wolfgang Tillmans, you could do whatever the fuck you wanted.
Yeah, yeah.
If
exactly.
You're Jim Herbert, you could do whatever you wanted.
Yeah,
if you're
yeah.
Anton Corbijn, shoot away. I don't care.
But yeah. You photographed yourself a lot. Wasn't there a project where you had a camera and you set it on a timer?
Yes.
So that it, like, and then you'd come into the picture every so often.
I was going to bed every night. I went to Georgia. My little dog was dying. She was 18, almost 19 years old. And I got the call that she was in her last week, and I needed to come help her die. And so I flew down from New York, and she was so happy to see me that she lived for 6 months.
Oh.
And I couldn't leave. So I left for a wedding for a day and a half, but I was there for 6 months to help her die. And I got really agitated because I'm not used to being anywhere for 6 months. It's very, very difficult for me. And there's not a lot of distraction there. So I started all these projects. I did all these works using books in 2009. This happened in 2009. There was this kind of general feeling that books were going to be gone, that we weren't going to have books anymore. Everything was going to be on a screen and backlit. Mm-hmm. And so I started using books like as a raw material to create sculpture pieces and drilling holes through them and doing all the stuff to kind of deface the idea of a book or to think of it as this useless brick. And I started doing all these photo things. I did screen grabs on my computer for the better part of that 6 months. And then I animated it into a 20-minute film of just everything I was looking at on my computer that year.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
And I took my camera every night when I went to sleep. I would place it on the shelf of my bathroom, in my bathroom, and I would photograph myself getting undressed to go to bed, or with the newspaper of the day, or with whatever T-shirt I had that someone had given me as a gift, or someone would send me something that because they knew I had total cabin fever, so they would send me something to distract me or to try to help me through it, and then I animated that into a 5-minute film. That first showed in a show in Greece, a group show about identity, and then another show in Japan after Fukushima.
Where would this exist now?
Fukushima. It only exists in my archive now.
Right.
But I have a show coming up that will be announced in a month. I think at least one of those pieces is going to wind up in that show.
Wow.
Anyway, yeah. So and there's a picture of me naked. Re-photographed off of my computer screen from
yes, that, I know that one. That yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And in your new video, like not the video, sorry, in the new bundle that you get from the single, there's like a portrait of you that actually moves.
That's right.
And that also is almost like you've photographed yourself at different points or something with different colors and lights and things.
It's all at one time, but it's using Polaroid film that was going to be thrown away.
Okay.
Because it had expired.
Ah.
And so rather than just throw it away, I thought, well, let's see what I can do with it. And I created for the release of Our Interference Times, a visual record. I did a special edition with 30 self-portraits, each unique of these Polaroids. So I had a lot left over.
Right.
If someone bought it for however much they paid for, I think it was $600. It wasn't that much, but so if someone bought it, I wanted it to be really perfect. I took all the imperfect ones, which I prefer, and made it into this GIF for the release of the single.
Wow. And talking about Polaroids, you own Andy Warhol's Polaroid camera.
I do, yeah.
How did that come about?
I saw it in a show and it was for sale and I bought it.
Really?
Totally weird, yeah. And I actually know the person who was selling it. I knew him actually as a musician. What I had forgotten is that he came to music or he arrived into the New York scene through Warhol's factory. And so he knew Warhol very well. And Andy went through a lot of Polaroids. It wasn't the only one that he ever owned, but it was one of his. And in fact, Russell, there was an exposed Polaroid in the camera when I got it.
Wow.
It had been broken. The camera was broken when Warhol gave it to his charge. And so I held on to that Polaroid as Warhol's last piece.
What is it? What is it? What's the image, or is it just like a fragmented?
It's a terrible Polaroid, to tell you the truth. It's not. There's no image on it. It's one of those Polaroids.
Overexposed.
It just goes to color. Yeah.
Wow. And can I ask you how much an Andy Warhol Polaroid camera would cost you?
I bought it for, I think it was $1,300.
Wow.
Not bad.
Wow.
And then I used it in the show for. I did a show in Brooklyn last year. Mm. For volume one. Mm. And I used the Polaroid as a part of a, I set up this thing that looked like an infinity mirror in space. These 1970s shaped shelving units. Mm. And I bought 10 of them, and I placed them one next to the other. And if you stood at the end of it, it looked like an infinity mirror. Mm-hmm. Wow. And then I placed everything that inspired me as a teenager from the 1970s into there. So it went from Warhol to the Velvet Underground to Patti Smith to Brancusi and all these art references and actual artifacts of my teen years. Because I was born January 4th, 1960. So when the decade turned 1970, I turned 10 years old 4 days later. And then when the decade turned 1980, I was no longer a teenager 4 days after. So that represented the early influences of me as a trying to be an artist, trying to be a creative person. Yeah.
And talking of Warhol as well, you actually met Warhol, didn't you?
Yeah.
Did you just meet him once?
He tried to pick me up. It was kind of cute.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Where was you?
It was in New York. It was at the Beacon Theater, which oddly, in the first book, in volume one, the Beacon Theater runs through it as this place where all these things happened to me one decade after another. Mm. All these incredible things happened to me in that theater.
You performed there, right, as well?
I performed there many times, but yeah. That's where Patti and Bob Dylan played. And
yeah. I saw Mariah Carey there do a Christmas album.
No.
So it's more or less the same.
Wow.
As well as your experience.
That's actually hysterical. I like Mariah Carey, I want to say.
Me too.
I like her very much. Yeah. I got in a lot of trouble early on because of a big mouth, but...
Why? What did you say?
Someone asked me. It was one of these. It was so stupid. I didn't want to tell you. It's one of these things where they're going to throw out a name and you have to respond as quickly as you can.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it was for a stupid music magazine that I won't even honor by naming here.
Okay.
And they said Mariah, and I said rhymes with pariah, which is a terrible. That's a terrible thing to say about anyone. Right. I actually think she's a really talented singer, and I know that she's. She's someone who's got a really good heart.
Yes.
And she's a really sweet person.
Did that get back to her?
It got back to her. It got back to her manager.
Oh.
Who wrote a letter to said magazine, which I won't honor.
Oh, God. Did you have a few sleepless nights about that? Or?
Well, yeah. That story will continue after the microphones are turned off. But Mariah...
Sorry, guys.
Mariah forgave me, I think, eventually. And I bumped into her at 2 a.m. late one night with my friend Cameron Diaz, and they had a little tussle over something that Cameron had said about Mariah.
Oh, no.
There was a lot of forgiving.
So you were just like, Mariah, we love you.
There were a lot of apologies and a lot of forgiving.
Yeah.
And everyone walked away from it beaming and feeling a little bit better about herself.
Well, that's good.
She's very tall. She's a big girl. She's strong.
Cool. Like,
she's really tall. You wouldn't expect that.
Wow.
Yep.
So talking about...
So you saw Mariah there.
Yeah, Andy Warhol. Yeah, Mariah. But Andy Warhol, sorry, about the Beacons.
Yeah. Welcome to my mind and how I think. This could go on for another decade.
Loving it.
Yeah, Warhol was at... it was the American Music Awards is the name of the thing. And Todd Eberle is a friend of mine who I met when he was a teenager. He would come up from Florida and stop in Athens on his way to New York, or because he and his friend, who I was dating at the time... loved Athens and loved the energy of the city and loved R.E.M. So they would stay with me. And Todd wanted to be a photographer, and we talked about it a lot. And he later told me that I gave him the courage to embark on a career as a photographer. And he became the portraitist for Vanity Fair for the better part of a decade.
Wow.
And went on to, he befriended Donald Judd and put out the first book of Judd's work when Judd was looking for someone to basically document his work in a way that he found appropriate. And Todd was exactly the person for that. Wow. So the year is 1985. We're at the Beacon Theater. It's a silly award show. And Todd Eberle comes running up to me, my friend Tom Gilroy, my best friend, and he says, Andy Warhol's on the fourth floor. You're going to take his picture with him. And I'm going to take your picture with him. And he throws me into the elevator, and we go up, and I'm like, what the fuck have I gotten myself into? We walk off the elevator, and there's Andy Warhol. And Todd's assistant has been holding him there, ready to be photographed with me. And so I sidle up next to him, and he says, hi, you're cute. And I said, thank you. And he said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a singer in a band. And he said, oh, you're a pop star. And I said, no, I'm a singer in a band. And he said, you're a pop star. And I said, no, I'm a singer in a band. And he said, can I have your phone number? And I said, yes. So I gave him my number. I wrote it on his award, somewhere in those boxes in the Warhol Foundation, somewhere buried in his time archive, capsules.
Yeah.
He would fill boxes up with every, he was a hoarder. He would fill boxes up with everything that came to him in his life that he didn't want to look at immediately. And he would just box them up. And when the box got full, he would tape it up and he'd start a new box. So somewhere in one of those hundreds of boxes of Warhol's time capsules is his American Music Awards award with my phone number on it, scratched out on the back of it. And
did he call you?
I don't know if he ever called me, Russell, because I didn't have an answering machine. It was 1985. I couldn't afford an answering machine. So Andy might well have called me for a date, and I don't know.
Would you have gone on the date with him?
I had this love-hate relationship with Andy, actually.
I wanted to ask you about that, because I heard that you had a kind of problematic feeling towards him.
I mean, you know, it was not a secret, even to a 25. I was 25 at the time, or 26. I was 25. It was not a secret then that people who came within his sphere often would be spit out and would have these terrible... and like he didn't take care of his people, basically. He wasn't very good at, he was good at bringing people in, but if they developed a drug problem or an alcohol problem or suffered from mental illness or something, whatever it was, or any combination of all those things, they could spin out of his sphere and you know, he didn't give a fuck. That was rumored, and I've spoken to people that know him quite well, and some of them say that was actually accurate to who he was.
Mm-hmm.
Others have a kinder take on it. But one way or the other, I did have a love-hate relationship with Warhol because I loved his work. I really do believe that his work is still resonating, profoundly resonating in everything contemporary that's happening now.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
My God,
will continue to. He was prescient in virtually every possible way. And he was a brilliant... he was just a brilliant mind.
Of course, yeah. So you collected his camera, but you're a collector in general, right? Would you describe yourself as a...
Yeah, I like... Well, but I'm not an art collector, so per se. I mean, I have my whole life. If I see something that I like and I can afford it, I would buy it just to put it on my wall. But I'm not a collector. I kind of run away from that word.
Do you?
Yeah.
I run towards it. But last time we met in New York, you were telling me about how you'd... acquired at auction the archive of Roy Cohn.
I did.
Which is kind of makes me think about your collecting sphere, what you sort of collecting. You like ephemera. Ephemera for you is like a really exciting thing. So you've still got this archive, and it's like a love-hate relationship to that, right?
It's a hate-hate.
Hate-hate.
I mean, you know, he was a human being. He was deeply flawed. He was an evil, awful person. I'm sure that there's something redeemable about his character. It's not up to me to decide what that is. But he was a person, and the most evil person on earth, we can each, if we're evolved enough, we can see ourselves in them. We can see how we could become that ourselves. And in recognizing that, we recognize our own humanity. In recognizing that, we forgive those who are the most horrible, the most wretched, the saddest, the most evil people on earth. And so, but that's not why I got it. I got it because I thought to myself, this is... completely weird. It's probably haunted. I don't want to touch it. I put on gloves. I went to the auction house. I flipped through it. It's a large box of stuff. And there's no mojo at all. It was completely neutral. There was nothing.
Are you quite sensitive to things
like
that?
I'm really sensitive to that, as is most members of my family. And for people that don't believe in that, go fuck yourself. It's real. Yeah. I was really worried about it. Roy Cohn's personal archive. I don't want to touch anything that he touched.
Yeah.
As it turns out, it was completely neutral. There was nothing there. Now, we're in London. One of, I, from, to my experience, the most haunted place on earth.
So what have you experienced here?
Horrible.
Horrible?
Well, horrible horrible nights trying to sleep in hotels that
really?
Used to be hospitals. Or but there's a lot of ghosts here. A lot.
Do you see ghosts?
No.
You just feel it?
Well.
It's an energy.
You feel it very intensely, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. But I do. Other people see them. I don't know. I mean, it's nothing special. I don't think it's just these channels open up, and you're either accepting or believing in it or not. And so, I think a lot of people who don't believe in that kind of thing probably have had some kind of experience that they can put down to something else.
Or they're too scared to say. It's a thing where you're just...
The other thing is, I don't really call that forward. I don't like talking about it so much. So we'll change the subject. But
okay.
London is very haunted.
Going back to Roy Cohn,
yeah.
I first learned about him very late in my life, actually, because Russ was in Angels in America, mm-hmm. and he's a character in Angels in America, and quite hideous character.
Yeah.
And I heard that archive that you bought, you actually were using to make a sculpture or an artwork related to it, using it?
Yes, I created a piece out of wood, out of pine and lead, to encapsulate Roy Cohn's personal archive. Right. And it's completed. And I'm actually, when I get back to New York, I'm looking for someone to show it. The time is now. None of us knew at the time when I bought it that the current American president would be the current American president.
No
one imagined that was possible. But of course, Roy Cohn
was his mentor,
and chose him as his chosen, basically as his charge and his chosen.
And
son.
They were close. And then when Roy Cohn got AIDS, Donald Trump
disappeared.
Completely disappeared.
Yeah.
Completely ignored him.
Yeah,
left him.
Left him there.
High and dry. It's almost Greek, isn't it?
I had forgotten that you were in Angels in America. Yeah. I have an interesting story that I think will resonate with what we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
I'm now friends with an AIDS activist who was one of the original members of ACT UP, who started ACT UP and now works with a group called Rise and Resist.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Her name is Ivy. She's a hero to me. She is the person who got the call from the nurse who was attending to Roy Cohn when he died to say, he's got the good drugs, come and get them.
Oh, so what Belize, the character Belize was based on, when he goes and steals all of his drugs to dispense to all of his friends that are dying who can't get access to
Ivy was the person who went to the hospital and stole
Roy
Cohn's drugs and handed them out to her friends who were most in need. Incredible. She's such a hero.
That's just giving me goosebumps.
I know.
My God.
Yeah.
And do you think Tony Kushner knew of Ivy, then knew of that story?
I don't know.
It's just like something that he... Was that common knowledge that the drugs went missing?
It might have been common. Yeah. I mean, well...
It's the kind of story that would
Dallas
probably...
Buyers Club.
Like a
folky sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like a Dallas Buyers Club kind of thing.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. I hope that I'm able to get the piece out of my apartment soon. I don't like it being there.
No, of course.
For a variety of reasons. I think it belongs in an institution.
And it should be exhibited in New York, I think.
It'd be interesting
really
to see where that gets put on. And it's very, I mean, it's so political.
I had interest from a place in Berlin. But I actually think New York is a better place.
It's got
totally.
To stay there. Yeah,
that was the city that Roy belonged to. And that's the city that the current president came from and
thinks is his own. Yeah,
it makes sense that it's there.
Well, we ask every guest that comes on two really serious questions.
Okay.
The first one is, if you could do an art heist, your touchstone artwork, anything in the world that you could live with forever, what would that be and why?
That I could live with?
Yeah.
Whoa. Fuck.
Maybe a Brancusi?
No. Well, no, Bernini.
A what?
Bernini. Sculpture. I'd get a Bernini.
Why?
I was going to say, because I actually read that there's going to be a show at the New Museum. I brought the paper with me to read on the train tonight. I'm on my way to Paris to Fiaxova, right, I think?
Yeah. I think it finishes Sunday evening.
Yeah, I'm not going for that. I'm doing a talk tomorrow night about the book. But,
oh, cool.
But my friend Prune Nori has a premiere of her movie about her experience with breast cancer, coming through breast cancer. She made a documentary. I think her therapist said that it was a good idea to pick up a camera.
Was that like Joe Spence? There's the artist
exactly.
Joe Spence who documented herself. Mm.
There's a show on in London right now, incredible.
At the Wealth Collection.
Yeah.
Wow.
I just saw the Freud show last night at the Royal Academy.
Yeah,
it opens this next week.
Self-portraits, yeah.
It's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
I strongly recommend it.
Yeah.
Prune.
So Bernini.
Fiac.
Yeah, the artwork.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the work like then, the sculptures by Bernini?
The most emotive and shockingly emotional portraits, busts. I think he used himself as a model for some of them. But they're these just incredibly moving sculpture pieces.
Where have you seen them before?
I've only seen them in books.
Really?
Yeah. Now, I was in Rome recently, but I was working. I didn't have time to go find some. But yeah, I think I'd go for a Bernini. Oh, I was reading a bit in the paper, the new museum in New York is going to have a show of Hans Hacke.
Great.
He's a fucking hero of mine.
Yeah.
I would say, but I don't really want to live with it. Condensation Cube, for me, is like the Mona Lisa of abstract art, and a piece that I did 11 years ago, I did a piece called A Cast of the Space Under My Cheap Plastic Chair, which was spinning off of Bruce Neumann.
Oh.
Well, Rachel took Bruce Neumann, but what I didn't know was that Bruce Neumann probably got the idea from Brancusi. Brancusi did a plaster cast of the space under a stool of his and used that as one of his plinths. And I think Bruce Neumann probably got the idea. Bruce Neumann's piece is called A Cast of the Space Under My Chair. His was a wooden chair. It's very beautiful. Rachel took that idea and expanded on it and made a career out of it. And she's a great artist as well, I think. But I did my own version of it using the line from The Graduate about plastics. It was around the time that Bruce did that piece, that Neumann did that piece, that they invented the first the plastic that was able they were able to squeeze out a single piece of plastic that was strong enough that it could be made into a chair that a human being could sit on without it collapsing, and that's the chair that we see everywhere now. So that's the cast that I made.
Wow. So Hans Hacke is going to be at the new museum next
year. Hans Hacke is at the new museum, and Condensation Cube is a great abstract piece that partly inspired my.
Would you steal that?
I wound up making that about me somehow. Well, the thing about the piece,
it always is, though. Art is very subjective and it's very personal. Yeah,
and I know myself better than anyone, and I don't know myself that well, and I guess I'm as self-absorbed as anyone. So there it is, but that's okay. The Condensation Cube changes with the amount of people that are in the room. It changes with the barometric pressure and the breath and the bodies and the heat that are moving through the room. So I wouldn't want to have it for myself because it wouldn't change very much. I would want it to be in a public place.
Mm.
Talking about you a bit more, I've just remembered that I think the first time I ever met you was in France at Chateau Lacoste, because you had done a sculpture installation outdoors.
That's right.
Can you talk a bit about that? I always wanted to ask you about it.
Yeah, thanks. That was my first sculpture piece.
Is it foxes?
It's foxes, yeah. And they're taken from a small plastic toy inspired by Douglas Copeland, who would take things that he liked and just blow them up really big just to see what they look like. And it was an experiment on my part to mimic what Doug was doing using this this plastic toy of a fox. And I blew it up and I created seven of them. And it's in two places in the south of France, at a private home, and it's Chateau Lacoste, and one place in Atlanta.
Is it permanent there?
It's permanent.
Yeah. Wow!
And
I was one of the first artists, actually. So, I was really honored to.
And if people haven't been there, it's the most incredible place to go because it's just stunning landscape, and you can walk through, and it's got everything from like a Tracy Emin to Louise Bourgeois to, you know, lots of different artists, but also kind of
a great architecture,
exactly, a bit like pavilions you would have at the Venice Biennale, but they would almost like take them from Venice and put them in the south of France. And it's an amazing place to stay, but not even just that, just for a day trip, it's incredible to see it. Yeah. And I remember at the time, that was the first time I think I met you, and you were very shy, and I just didn't get to ask you
And I think I'm very,
if
like...
If I was remarkable or not?
I just, the compliment is if you're very unremarkable. Unmemorable is
unmemorable.
Like, that's a compliment.
Unmemorable.
Well, the piece was memorable because I'd strolled along going up maybe to see Tracy's. No, Tracy's wasn't there yet, maybe. I can't remember. No. But anyway, I was wandering around anyway. And I was dying to know what it was about, but I didn't have any information. I was going to ask you, and then I felt too embarrassed because I thought I was being too overbearing.
Oh.
But yeah, so that, I'm glad we've finally spoken about that because I didn't know that it was from a toy.
Thanks. Yeah.
Yeah, the other question we would ask all...
I consider it my first sculpture piece. That
really?
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
It's bronze.
The other...
I just want to jump in just to say about art, because there was a quote which you wrote, which is saying that in art, what you look for is something that encourages you forward, which for me really struck a chord. I think that's such a beautiful way of summing up what art does as a personal journey, because so many times I see artists and artworks and it encourages me to keep going forward, to keep discovering, to keep wanting to learn.
When I see a great show at an institution or a museum, I walk out into the street and it could be raining, it could be shitty old, smelly old, nasty old, sad old New York, but you look at everything differently.
Yeah,
something about seeing a great body of work by a Freud or by a Tracy Emin or by Sam Taylor Johnson or whomever, Hans Hacke, you walk out and it changes your perception of the rest of your world, even for a brief moment. Mm-hmm. And if music can do that, if dance can do that, if video can do that, if art can do that, then it's taking all of us and it's placing us where we are in the present moment. And I think in a very positive, hopefully a very positive way, progressively pushing us forward to imagine what would life be if we were able to acknowledge everything with such awe and such wonder. Who would we be to ourselves? Who would we be to the world that we're cohabiting with? Is that a word, cohabiting? Cohabitating?
Yeah.
With all these other species?
You know, one of the things I've been thinking about before we met you is this idea of greatness, inspiring greatness, and how you can somehow be inspired by people's art or their music or different even acts of kindness or something, and how that can inspire other people to do great things. And I feel like your story, if you think about you listening to Horses by Patti Smith and then you going out and forming a band and then, you know, changing the world with your music in a way, one of the most powerful things I remember of you is your era where you were like wearing makeup.
Yeah.
And you were you weren't openly gay necessarily, but I don't at that point, perhaps, I'm not really sure, but I remember you being this figure for me. And it wasn't like I was a massive REM fan or anything. I was listening to like Tori Amos and Madonna and mainly female singers, actually.
Sure.
But REM was a band that, because the songs were so strong, would come to me every so often. So you'd sort of, they'd be around me. And the thing that really connected me to you, though, was your physicality and your performance style, like performance art in a way. Mm-hmm. But when you started wearing makeup, I remember watching you on British TV and you did some song, I don't know if it was Orchid or not, what's the song called?
Orchid? What did you say?
Not Orchid. You wrote a song. I can't remember what it was called now. But not Oyster. What the hell was it called?
Lotus.
Okay, yeah. Exactly. That era,
yeah.
The way you were presenting yourself, you became this very like other figure that wasn't even... Because back then I was really thinking about being gay. Mm-hmm. And it was very much like, am I gay? This is my identity. And you try and like tag yourself into something that you belong to. And
Well, you look for someone that you can connect with.
Precisely. And you were the artist for me that made me realize it was okay to be who you are, regardless of whether you're gay or straight, it doesn't matter, because you were somehow becoming this figure of otherness, which now we've got many figures of otherness in a way. It's becoming much more mainstream in a great way. You know, you think of Antonina Johnson's, you know, Anoni, and you think of all these amazing artists who have come since then.
Yeah.
But I really do think that was one of the most important things in culture at that point.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say thank you for that, because it's genuine, and I don't mean to be cheesy or naff, but it's like,
cheesy.
I really tried to think about what you represented to me.
Was that scary for you, like going out there and doing that with that sort of attention?
It's funny, I've been talking about it all week because it was 25 years ago. It was the lead up to the release of Monster, which was a record about as music fans, we were using glam rock for the first time as a jumping off point for a way to kind of reinvent what we were trying to approach musically. We just put out these two really quiet records that were the two biggest records of our entire career and had not toured either of them, and we were about to go on a tour, so we needed to write loud songs, and we used glam rock, and I decided this is the time when I'm going to present myself publicly, present my sexuality for the first time.
Right.
It wasn't very well received, I have to say, because I am somewhere in between And although I most definitely prefer men, that's for sure. But I've loved women in my life, and it was real, and it continues to be. So there's that. But it was 25 years ago. I've been talking about it all week long, and I'm so glad that I did it. It was terrifying at the time.
It was, right.
In music, there was Boy George, who was, so flamboyantly over the top with the way he presented himself. And then there was Katie Lang, but there was no one else. That was basically it. There was Elton, of course. David Bowie had kind of reneged on what he had said in the early 70s. Mark Bolan died before he could really present himself. There really were no other people.
Well, Pete Burns, I guess, was he someone who was doing that then, or was that later?
Maybe this was in 94.
That's what I was going to say, because the people you're talking about were before. I mean, KD wasn't so much. She was early 90s. But I think like the figures you're talking about were literally 10 years before.
Because
if you think of performance art like Lee Bowery, I mean, late 70s, early 80s. I mean, that's kind of... So it was quite an unusual thing when you suddenly presented yourself in that way.
Everything locked down a lot more when Thatcher and Reagan became... things got very conservative. And then, of course, AIDS made it very difficult to be queer in any possible way.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you for saying that.
That was brave.
I mean, nothing touches me more closely than when people say that to me.
The other thing I just want to say for everyone listening to this, if you haven't seen Michael's photographs yet, because many of you might not have, I guess, because I mean, I wasn't really that familiar with your photography, to be honest, but it's something that has followed the whole way through your life. And I personally love these photographs because I think they're portraits of people, but they're not necessarily, you don't often see their faces. And your hands appear a lot. So I think you photographed your father's hands, Kurt Cobain's hands, like friends of yours. And those portraits, just to me, are like, they sum up the soul of a human.
But you said they don't have to contain a face to be a portrait.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what's so special about your work, actually, your photography, is because like yourself, I remember saying to Russ the other day that sometimes when I've spoken to you over the years, we had dinner in New York recently, I'll ask you something and then you pause and you think about it and then you answer. You're not someone who just blurts out like I do, like,
you don't blurt. You're not a blurter.
I am a blurter. I love just talking.
Yeah.
I mean, it's normally what I'm thinking and what I feel, but I do just come out with
you
stuff.
You do.
But I think that sensitivity that you have, it really is in the photography. It's the way you kind of look at the world and you notice things that other people don't notice, which is what is so great about art. So I really urge people to buy these books, Volume 1, and also our Interference Times
a visual record,
which is a collaboration as well with Douglas Copeland, who incidentally I was in the taxi with you.
And if you go to Hatchards and Piccadilly, there might be some signed copies available still.
I signed a bunch of copies today.
And then you can work out for yourself if it's a good signature or a bad signature.
Love it. And the final question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
Blue.
Oh,
that came right out. Yeah,
it did. Yeah, blurted it out.
Yeah, actually, marigold. I like marigold right now, but blue.
Marigold's
blue,
like a yellow, like the gloves.
Yeah, like the color of. I sat up, bolt upright in bed at 9 o'clock in the morning in a hotel room in New Orleans, in the middle of making a record, alone.
Haunted? Was it a haunted room?
It was not haunted, but it was one of the only places in New Orleans that isn't.
Yeah,
I love New Orleans, by the way, but. I sat bolt upright in bed and yelled the word saffron. And then I was like, what the fuck was that about? I mean, I don't wake up at 9 a.m. I don't sit bolt upright in bed. And I certainly don't yell to an empty room.
Colors.
And so the whole day I was in the studio and I was like, what the fuck was that about? And I finally realized that my favorite color at the time was a certain color named after a root of a plant that I don't know how to pronounce. And my unconscious was preventing me from embarrassing myself because I didn't know if it was turmeric or turmeric.
Turmeric, isn't it? Turmeric.
Turmeric.
There's so many different things.
So instead of yelling turmeric to myself, I yelled saffron, which is a very close color.
Yes.
Isn't that weird?
It's a spice as well. Yeah.
But don't you work out a lot of things in dreams? Because I heard, didn't you do a work about or a song about LB?
I did a reach about. I had no reach around. LB was a dream that I had where I was invited to a party and I was the only person there without the initials LB. And I do, and if you look back through REM and even the books, I mean, it's present in all my work. I make lists. There are list songs and the song that the list of LB people, there were about 50 people that I named, in fact. I woke up and wrote down every name that I could remember. Louise Bourgeois was in there, Lester Bangs, the art critic, the music critic, Leonid Brezhnev, Lenny Bruce. It went into a song called It's the End of the World as We Know It.
Love.
Which was a list song. So it's just listing all the terrible things that bring about, you know, the end of time.
And
yay.
One question.
Sure.
REM, was that a dream? Coming up with your band name, Rapid Eye Movement.
We pulled it out of a dictionary. I found it. But I realized looking back, of course, that my dreamscape and the world of the unconscious or of the subconscious has always worked its way into my work, my contribution to that band, all the way back to the beginning. The name, I think, was a good bit of kismet because it does describe a lot of. I mean, Day Sleeper is exactly that. Day Sleeper was a woman portrayed by me as a man in the video, as a poor sad guy who can't, who's at the end. I don't know how you interpret the song, but at the end of her emotional powers because of having this schedule that's upside down and working this job that's really mundane and that she's not interested in at all, but it's how she pays the bills. It's she's locked into it. So it has this kind of vaguely 1984, you know, Orwellian feeling to it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
John Hurt, my God, that's another one who left us. Mm-hmm. I love John Hurt so much.
John Hurt was so great.
I mean, Naked Civil Servant.
Oh, yeah. So good.
Mike Mills my former bass player, invited me to dinner once in Los Angeles to this Italian restaurant that I think Robert De Niro owned. It starts with an A, aha. It's called Aji or Ala or something. He invited me to dinner, didn't tell me that I was having dinner with John Hurt, who he had met. And I arrived at the restaurant. I was introduced to John Hurt. I like picked my jaw up off the ground and we walked in to sit down at the table. Only to run into Tony Curtis, wearing a very, very bad wig, and his wife, who had very large breasts.
Oh, my God.
So by the time we got to the table, I was just like, holy fucking Christ, I'm at dinner with John Hurt, and that's Tony Curtis and his wife. And
that is breasts. Like overload.
It was a lot.
Yeah.
That was L.A. in the 90s.
I think you've had a lot of them stories in your life.
John Hurt was a big part of that show that I put together, my influences from the 1970s.
With the Infinity Mirror.
The Infinity Mirror, yeah.
But actually, I think you've used photography, like, summing all this up now, but to make sense of all of this life, you know, because you've had this extraordinary, and I know you've described it as being lucky, but I just don't see it as that, because I think somehow you've found a family, you know, through what you've done, and you found like-minded people, whether they know you or don't know you. You know, you've connected with millions of people all over the world, and you kind of created that for yourself, and that was obviously your destiny or whatever. But I love that in the work as well. Like, there's photographs of your first boyfriend or one of your early boyfriends, Jeremy
Ayres.
Yeah. And I liked this idea that you said that relationship almost made you see the fun side of life as well. So that it wasn't just all about cerebral, intense you, but somehow you found the lightness and the happiness, shiny, happy people almost.
He taught me how to laugh. He taught me how to dance.
Yeah, which I really liked though. I was really into that idea of like positive influence, because I've had that with Russ. Like before I met Russell, I was like in a pop band, deadly serious, took everything way too seriously the whole time.
I used to swear and he'd put his hands up to his ears.
Yeah. Like, I was like, at the age of 25, I was like, you know, really intensely trying to do the right thing, because I felt like I had to do the right thing for my record label or whatever. And I think those friendships are so important, and your friends do become family. But I loved that story about Jeremy as well, this idea that you have to, even if you are super intense, you have to let yourself have happiness. And then it brought me to your song, Shiny Happy People, because it's like,
that's
the best pop song ever.
We can't end on that, though.
No.
Jeremy actually introduced me to Edith Sitwell. So that's why I know so much about the Sitwells. And that was
the Planted Jets.
The Planted Jeanettes. And that was part of my early introduction to England. So I knew about them coming over, and I was so excited to finally be in London where they lived. But he also, and I didn't know this when we had our very brief affair, I was the other man. I was really in love with him, or I thought I was at the time, but he became this profoundly important mentor to me, and we were friends until his early death, his unfortunate early death. But Jeremy was, when he lived in New York, he was a drag queen named Silva Thin, who was a part of Warhol's factory. And Warhol loved Silva, loved her. And but Gerard Malanga, who was doing, or was it Gerard or Paul Morrissey? Paul Morrissey did not like her. I don't know why. I don't know what happened. But she never made it into any of the films.
Wow.
For that reason. But Andy loved Silva, or Jeremy S. Silva.
Amazing.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Mm.
So I think it's, it, no, it's not in the book, but it was in the show. These an homage to Jeremy and his own work as an artist and as a creative person. He was a poet. He was a writer. He was a painter. He was this astonishing dancer. He was this incredible force. But there's a picture of him as Silva Thin. Ah, I'm gonna cry.
Oh,
it's okay. A picture of him as Silva, and behind him is the word capricious. And that's where the song came from.
Wow, yeah. For your capricious soul. Yeah.
And that's a good way to
end it.
But that was the inspiration for the character that I created for that song as a teenager who's coming into her own self.
That's beautiful.
Under some beautiful influence.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much,
Michael. Oh,
my God.
I didn't expect to cry today. That was beautiful. Thank you guys very much for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming on, mate.
Yeah.
And it's been a privilege. And for everyone listening, we are going to post pictures on @talkart on Instagram, which Michael is no longer on, but he was briefly on Instagram and did a prolific amount of posting with his amazing beard at the time, with many famous people.
Oh, yeah, I remember that beard.
Honestly, it was the best thing. It was about a year or something.
I love my beard.
How long were you on there for?
Well, I quit Instagram 3 times, and this third time, I read the book by Jaron Lanier,
yes.
10 Reasons to Quit Your Social Media Now, and I said, that's it, I'm done.
Yeah.
I just don't like Facebook.
I don't know this book. I don't want to read this book.
Yeah. I don't think you'll be allowed to with your movie contracts and all that.
Not.
But I loved that Instagram account, though, because you were with all these famous people, and then you would push yourself into the frame more than them with your huge beard, and I was just like, this rules.
Yeah.
And then you disappeared. It was brilliant.
Thank you.
So it was that was a performance piece in itself.
Thank you.
But we'll be posting pictures to our Instagram @talkart.
And I'm sure people are going to pick us up on Plantagenets, Plantagenets.
Let's celebrate the idea that we can say things in many different ways.
Basil, basil.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe that's not right.
Tomato, tomato.
But yeah.
Turmeric.
Exactly. Lots of love, everyone.
Big
we'll
dreams.
Be back soon. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram @talkart, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.